Hello, I'm Toby Davey, and welcome to this extended version of my interview with Ben Ringham, one half of Ben and Max Ringham, who created the immersive binaural sound design for the Donmar Warehouse critically acclaimed production of Blindness. Blindness is a socially distant sound installation at the Donmar Warehouse, adapted by Simon Stevens from Jorge Saramago's dystopian novel Blindness, directed by Walter Mayer Johan, with Juliet Stevenson voicing the role of the narrator and the doctor's wife in this gripping story of the rise and hopeful end of an unimaginable global pandemic. When I met up with Ben via Zoom, we chatted about how he and Max had got involved in working on Blindness, how they created the binaural sound design, where some of the sound effects came from, what it was like working with Juliet Stevenson, Ben's thought on the merging of music, performance and theatre, some of the R&D sound projects they have been working on with the BBC and one for Bose Frames, and what their next project might be. I first began by asking Ben about his and Max's background in music, their work with the Shunt Collective, and their first theatre gig working on Nicholas Heitner's National Theatre production of Henry IV.
So Max and I were very fortunate because we had a father who was an actor, and he was obsessed with Bach, so we had a beautiful grand piano in our front room. When Max was probably about 12 or 13, he started getting into synthesizers. And I, being 4 years younger, used to just go in and play with all his synths because I'd already started to learn to play the piano. And over our teen years, we just started building a studio together out of necessity more than anything else, because we realized pretty quickly that if we actually pooled our resources, we could get a lot more. So the studio just grew from when we were very young. I mean, Max, like I said, bought his first synthesizer when he was 13, which means I was 9. And I had a guitar and a drum kit, and we just built it like that. And then when I was in my early 20s, we decided to take the studio out of the parents' house and actually make a go of it. So we started releasing dance music together and doing as much TV work as we possibly could. And at the same time, our sister was studying at Central School for Speech and Drama and met a bunch of people there and set up the Shunt Collective. And they started coming to us and asking us to write the music for their shows and do the sound. And we didn't think anything of it, to be honest. We did it rather as a favour than a life choice. It was a bit of a chore, to be honest. As that grew, so our experience within theatre grew, until there was a point where Shunt made a show called Tropicana, which was made in conjunction with the National Theatre. And Nicholas Heitner came down to the Arches and came over and said some very nice things to us about the music. And we turned around to him and said, well, look, if you like it so much, why don't you give us a job? To which he did give us a job. And he offered us Henry IV, Part 1 and 2 at the National in the Olivier, which was our first theatre job. And that was baptism by fire. We had no idea about what theatre actually really was. We didn't know how stage management worked or how the sound department worked or what rehearsals really were. But it was amazing. And we learned a huge amount. And we thought it was going to be the only thing that we actually did. Strangely, at the same time, about 6 months before that, we had signed to a record label to release our first Super Thriller album. So at the same time as doing that first show at the National, we were also going on tour around Europe with Beck and playing these big gigs in front of like 5,000-10,000 people. And so for about 3-4 years, our theatre career and our band kind of ran in tandem with one another. We would go off on tour around Europe, and then we'd come back and we'd do a couple of shows, and then we'd go back out on tour. And it's a lot of fun. And then both Max and I had children, and we decided that we would give theatre much more of our attention. And so that's basically how we ended up where we are. For Max and myself, music and sound are not separate. They're one and the same thing. So all of the work on Blindness is music, as far as we're concerned. All the tones and the use of all the sound. I think when you go and see a really good sound designer, what they craft is musical. It's music.
And going back to the Henry IV days, What was it like having your first theatre gig on the Olivier stage, with sort of renowned stage where great actors had performed?
Yeah, I mean, it was incredible because we kind of bypassed what most people spend like 15 years trying to get to. And I think Minimax's complete lack of understanding of what was going on in theatre actually helped us in that respect, because we could just turn around to Nick and say, you know, give us a gig, it'd be a laugh. Not really understanding what we were saying to him at all. It was an amazing experience. Looking back on it now, I'm surprised how, especially the first like 8 weeks of rehearsal, I just wasn't daunted or scared by it at all. I had zero kind of comprehension of what we were actually doing. When we actually hit the tech and the previews, I didn't sleep for 3 weeks, and neither did Max.
Gosh.
So it's a big change to go from shunt, which is essentially images, you're scoring images and moments as opposed to scenes. And so quite often the text in shunt is not as important as the whole experience. So quite often the sound is far louder than it would be in any other theatre. So for Max and I, we had this steep learning curve of trying to understand how you actually properly underscore something that is your responsibility. So quite often you'd put the music in and it would be like, turn it down a little bit more, turn it down a bit more, turn it down a bit more. Okay, now. And all you could hear was a single note, you know, and all the subtlety had gone. So I mean, Max and I had this big idea that we would make all these little rhythms out of crackles, which is quite commonplace now, but at the time no one was really doing it. And so there were people doing that, that's not true, but we didn't know of anyone who was doing it. So we made all these, we got some static from an old film, and we cut up all the static and made rhythms out of it. And I found out years later that show had more complaints than any other show, because everyone thought that the sound system had broken because of all the crackles that we put through it.
I think you also wanted to use all the speakers in the theatre, not just the ones in the theatre, but the ones in the foyer as well. Was that sort of the beginnings of this immersive experience for the audience?
To be honest with you, like, because of our experience with shunt, which still carries through to today, we struggle to feel like happy being contained in a single space. Like, shunt was and is all about this kind of like world of possibilities, and the idea that you weren't kind of confined to the department that you are working in. I was just as likely to be writing music as I was to be digging a hole in the middle of the set so that someone could pull a pineapple out and smash it. So when we went to the Olivier and we were working in that space and we found out how many speakers there were there, the first thing we thought was, let's have that texture that we're starting off in the theatre, have the audience hear it when they first walk into the foyer. And I remember clearly sitting in one of those massive production meetings with like 80 people, and we suggested that we'd come in on Sunday to fit some speakers in the hallway if they wanted. And the production manager very politely said, don't worry, I think we have a sound department who can do that for you. You know, we literally had no idea. And something that we always laugh about was after previews, you always have note session with the note sessions with the director. Max and I had no idea about this, so we just went down to the bar and patted ourselves on the back for a fantastic bit of work we'd done, and thought we'd just go home. And the company stage management looked all over the building for us and came down and was like, everyone is waiting in the theatre for you so we can do notes. And we had no idea. It was very embarrassing. Yeah, those times.
And I suppose working with, you know, the Shunt Collective and experiencing all that work with merging music and performance was a sort of basis for the stuff that you were doing for Henry IV and other productions. Do you think there was a real sort of merging of theatre and music, which has become almost, I would say, not necessarily the norm, but it's certainly used a lot more now in theatre productions?
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, like I said, we had no idea that there was a job called a sound designer in theatre. It really wasn't on our radar in any way, shape or form. And again, the experience of working with Shunt allowed us to come at the productions in a very different way than I think we would have done if we'd been trained and we'd gone into it thinking that that's what we really wanted to do. I mean, there was a lot of other people doing it as well, you know, like Adam Cork, who was doing a lot of stuff at the Donmar at the time in that realm as well. And we were also very fortunate to find a young director very early in our theatre career, Jamie Lloyd, who was so kind of savvy when it came to music and sound and really truly understood how to use each of those elements. And when they were, it was so important for them to be one and the same, you know, like you want music to come out of a storm as opposed to there being a storm, then music, then the next bit. You want them to be one whole piece. So that was incredibly fortunate for us, I think. Our relationship with Jamie has been a massive, massive part of our career.
And it's interesting to see music concerts becoming more theatrical. My wife and I were incredibly lucky to get tickets to see Kate Bush's Before the Dawn show, which wasn't really a concert. It was more of an experience. And I think that seems to be happening a lot more. When you look at the design of music concerts, it's more of a theatrical experience. And there seems to be much more of a blurring of the two, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's really exciting. And I think that there is an understanding of being able to use multiple forms together to push things forward. I mean, I also think the development of immersive theatre and a more savvy audience makes them expect more as well. I mean, like Nick Heitner does at the Bridge now, you know, those shows which are a real hybrid of styles, you know, doing Midsummer Night's Dream in a very immersive way.
Yeah, in the round and yeah.
So yeah, it's a really interesting time. I wish I'd seen that Kate Bush show, actually. It sounded incredible.
Yeah, it was. Obviously, you've just been working on the production of Blindness for the Donmar Warehouse. How did that project come about? How did you get involved? What was the sort of start point of it?
Max and I have worked with binaural sound for a very long time. We started off with a man called David Rosenberg, who was part of the Shunt Collective and is along with Glenn Neath and their company Darkfield. They're real pioneers of this stuff. And we have been fortunate to start out with David on his journey. And over the last 10 years, we've done a lot of different projects with binaural sound. So we've done a couple of projects with BBC R&D. We've done quite a few dance shows, again, with David. And then last year, we had our own show that we co-created with Anna Hickson called Anna, which was a show in the Dorfman. And that was a live binaural sound show where we had a single character that you followed around. So we did all those shows. Anna was like a live binaural show where it's a single character that you were following around and the audience were all in headphones. And we worked on that for 5 years. When the Donmar started thinking about this show, they contacted us, among others, and asked if we'd be interested in working with Simon Stevens and Walter, who was the director, to bring it to life. And it was a very, very fast turnaround. I mean, we got contacted the last week of June. We had a brief meeting with Walter at the beginning of July. And then within a week, we were in the rehearsal rooms at the Donmar doing prelim work for when Juliet Stevens would come in. So it was a really fast turnaround. All of the discussions were very fast. And it was kind of like a show unlike any other. I said this to a friend of mine the other day. Doing this production was a little bit like a foot in the past of what it was like to make shows and a foot in the future of what it might be like in the future for us to be able to make shows again, you know? So it was a very strange experience, and it was a really lovely, beautiful experience as well, because we were extremely fortunate with Jessica, who did the lights and who's brilliant, and Lizzie, who is the set designer, who again also was part of the Shunt Collective. So it felt very much like a family coming together in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, I sadly couldn't make it to the Donmar, but I listened to the podcast version and also listened to the interview between Simon and Hannah Thompson, the partially blind, as she calls herself, consultant on the show, and also listened to the vocalised introductory notes. And I thought, you know, the whole immersive surround sound experience was incredible. And it really did take me to those spaces and places and locations of the show. And, you know, Juliet Stevenson's narration and characters were just really took me on that journey. And I wondered, because when I was looking at it and thinking about the show, I wondered how you might do some of the sounds, you know, like with the scene, the very beginning of the show, where the main character becomes blinded at the traffic lights, and when he goes back to his flat and he's taken there, guided there, and stumbles around smashing vases and stuff. And I think you didn't want it to become more of a radio play. It was more of a theatrical experience where, that, you know, as we all know, less is more kind of thing. And it was almost bits or elements of suggestions that took you on that journey. Was that a real sort of mindset of yours and Max at the beginning to make it not like a radio play?
Absolutely. Completely. Like, from the moment we read it, the first thing that we both said to each other, almost talking over each other and then led to another argument, was that we don't want to make it a radio play. The last thing we wanted to do was be naturalistic. And there are very few actual naturalistic sounds in it. You know, you've got the sound of rain and you've got the occasional sound of traffic, but everything else is representative of. So there's quite a few different concepts that we came up with. The first one is this: the show is in three parts, and we decided that each part would have a concept and a conceit of its own. So the beginning is very much told as a narrative, and like you say, you could have followed the stage directions, which she almost says as well. Mm. I mean, like the amber light flash at the beginning and the sound of the car pulling up and all those things. And what Max and I decided to do in the first part was say, these are places, but they're not inhabited. So you might hear the sound of what might be made in those places, but they are not representative of what is being said at that time. So right at the beginning, we decided that when we were inside the car, we would have the sounds that you would hear inside a car, but that aren't necessarily being used at that specific point. So we decided to put the indicator on. Because it's a sound that you absolutely understand is within a car. Did you hear that?
Yeah, that's what stood out for me. That was one of the things I noted, because I've listened to the podcast a couple of times, and the first time I listened to it, I heard the ticking and I thought, that's an indicator.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like it's the concept of like what sounds are in an empty room, even if there's not a human there. The indicator was the thing that we sold to Walter when we were discussing this before we'd actually done any work at all. I turned around to him and said, "What if these spaces are spaces that exist with no human in them, but they are tones and textures and sounds like an indicator that you hear within a car?" So, like, a couple of beats after that, when they're in the house, you have this weird oscillating sound that I recorded. Max and I were having a conversation on Zoom about how to edit a piece of music that we'd written ages ago. And we talked about it and he said, okay, I'll do a little bit of work. And while I was sitting there waiting for him to do it, this weird feedback loop started, that oscillating in between our two computers. So I just recorded that. And it sounds like a ladder effect kind of distortion. So I put that behind the scene when they're in the house with the idea that it's a computer that's just feeding back. And it's things like that. It's just like finding connections that just hint at where you might be. It makes it a lot more fun to do as well.
Yeah. And there are some nice sort of, I suppose, indications of scene changes, the piano notes and the clicking and the sort of almost like static sound that you would get on a TV when you were changing channels. There were really nice bits like that, which popped up now and again when scenes were changing.
Oh, man. My favourite sound in the entire show is in that. There's a door at the Harold Pinter Theatre that when it closes, it makes this amazing whoom sound. So just before that piano note that you hear, there's like a swell and then there's a piano note. And that swell is the door from the Harold Pinter Theatre.
Gosh,
which is kind of exciting for me anyway. So that's part one. And then part two is very pure kind of binaural sound. And that was the real heavy, heavy work that we did with Juliet, Walter, myself, Max, and Simon. And Juliet spent like 4 or 5 days.
Gosh.
All in, just every day from like as early as possible to as late as we could go, working through all those scenes. And I would say 90% of those scenes are recorded as you hear them, and there are no edits in them.
Did you use that same sort of technique as you did with Anna, of, you know, having a microphone, the microphone set up, and was Juliet walking around, or was it sort of more done in post-production? Because it sounded real.
It's all her walking around. So it's essentially all we've got is a microphone called a KU-100, which is a head mic that has a microphone in each ear. And we plotted the entire show around that head. The Donmar have a rehearsal room, which is a virtual replica of the stage at the Donmar. So it's a similar size room. It's not as high. And it's not quite as wide, but it has the same dimensions, which is really important for binaural, because getting the audience to go and sit down in the space, you want them to feel as much as possible like they're hearing the room that they've been in. And we spent days just plotting her movement around the space. I said this to them right at the beginning, to everyone in the room. The thing about binaural sound, the thing about sound is it's really an individual thing. You know, the way you listen to things is so individual. And we don't talk about that at all. We talk about how you might see things differently, but you don't talk about how you might hear things differently. And I love that. I think it's one of the most amazing things. So I said to them right at the beginning, there's loads of rules about how you record with a microphone. But like with everything, you know, you break those rules. And I can tell you all the ideas I have, but it's going to be a lot more interesting if everyone else like comes on board and goes, what if you do this? What if you do that? What if we go over here? What if we like smash all these chairs? You know, that brilliant moment where Juliet runs across the back, pushing all the chairs, shouting, get out, get out. Yes. You can't come in here. That was entirely Juliet. She was like, I feel like I need to move all this.
Gosh.
And it was exhilarating. I love the idea of telling stories through sound and not in a radio play kind of way. Not that that's a bad thing. That's just a different thing. But in that theatrical space, saying, you know, the sound can carry the narrative. You can hold a moment in silence, but that silence carries an emotion in itself. That's amazing to me. I really love it.
There's one scene which felt really real to me was a part when the doctor was being guided into the mental hospital, the asylum, the isolation center, and she was guiding him along the wall and walking up the steps. And it was just, it felt so real to me because the way the dialogue was being delivered and the dialogue itself was very much how somebody would be walking with me and giving me directions of how to, you know, be guided up some steps and stuff. And it sounded so real. It sounded as if you were in a courtyard somewhere.
We were. that was one of the hardest to do, right? So the great thing is there is a courtyard right next to the rehearsal room, which we use extensively. So all those times that Juliet is shouting at the guards to give them more food, she is actually out in the courtyard shouting at people. And one occasion we had someone shout back, which was unnerving. But that first scene, I carried the head in with her. So when she's saying a little to the left, a little to the right, she's saying it to me. And I'm trying desperately not to drop the head, which is extremely heavy. So that whole, we tried to be as honest as possible with everything that we did with the head. So the man who is dying, who gets stabbed by the woman in the leg. We built a bed for him and put sheets on it so that every time that Juliet would go and talk to him, she would have real sheets to pull back. Max and I wanted to do as little sound processing as possible during part two, so that the kind of honesty of the recording was paramount, because Juliet's performance is so strong. Mm. You don't want to you don't want to take away from that at all. You want to be, it's like recording a really amazing musician, you know, you want to put very little reverb on it. You don't want to put any like compression on it. You want to hear all of the peaks and troughs. And she was incredible for that.
I mean, her performance is just so incredible in it. And it's, you know, it just takes you on that journey. And even, you know, sort of when they go out of the asylum and she's going into the supermarket and going around the cityscape and coming back and, you know, the scene with the rain beating down on her and on the balcony, you know, you are taken there. You're there. That's the beauty of it.
Yeah. Like, this is the thing. She made our job insanely easy. So every time anyone gives us any compliments, I just sit there thinking, my God, it's Juliet. She's basically made our life a total joy. So the three parts were what we said about part one, the binaural in part two and part three. We decided we wanted to try and keep quite sparse and allow the story to tell itself. And just come and bring in bits of music at particular moments that we wrote specifically for those moments. And then just the rain. And yeah, she really was an absolute joy to work with.
Do you think this type of theatre is possibly going to become the new norm at the moment with, what we're in at the moment with social distancing and theatre sort of slowly opening up? But do you think there's more of an opportunity for theatres to become more creative with sound installations and, like, I listening to it, not in the theatre, but listening at home? Do you think there's more opportunity for this type of work?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned Darkfield earlier, and they've been doing headphone-based shows in the dark for quite some time. They're a really interesting company, and I think that they've got a couple of shows that you can listen to at home as well, which are binaural and interesting. I think in terms of creativity, I really hope that we are going to get more of a chance over the next 6 months to try and do interesting sound, video, designer-led projects as well. I think that the nature of where we sit at the moment, with the buildings being essentially closed off, not now due to the government saying they can't be open, but because, you know, socially distanced theatre just is not economically possible for 90% of the theatres in this country. And with support looking like thin, to say the best.
Non-existent.
You know, it's, you know, a freelance community in theatre of 270,000 people that are really not really being supported. And I think that we have a brilliant opportunity for designer-led theatre to really push some boundaries outside of buildings for the time being, which is, you know, is really exciting. I mean, as an industry, we have some incredible minds, and it's not too small to say it's devastating, actually, what's happening at the moment. Like, really, it's really hard. And we speak to people all the time who are having an awful time. And I know it's not just theatre, but theatre is particularly badly hit. And it is devastating. But hopefully we can find some real positives in this, and there can be some amazing, amazing, innovative ideas coming through. Yeah, so hopefully. And if it's sound, I'm over the moon about that.
What's next for you and Max at the moment? What are you working on at the moment? Any projects in the pipeline?
We're like, I mean, we, to be honest with you, blindness was an exception to the rule, and it was a really beautiful exception. And I'm so glad we got the opportunity to do it. We have a number of projects that are waiting to happen, both our own and with other people. But getting any sort of green light at the moment is pretty difficult. I would be surprised if we don't do another show in the next 3 months. But, you know, this is a surprising year. So, we had a project that was 99% there, and it got canned on Friday. It's hard times. But, I mean, I can't, you know, complain too much. Max and I have a lot of different avenues that we work in. So we do theatre. We still release music. We do a lot of different things. So We really are very fortunate. Thankfully, we've got a couple of R&Ds coming up. We're doing a musical, writing a musical with Payne's Plough, with a writer called Chino, who I knew when I was quite young, who's brilliant. And I'm really excited by that. There's possibilities all over the place. It's just waiting for someone to say, yes, you can definitely do that.
Do you think you'll do another project like the Isolation Chamber? I was going to say Alexa, but I probably shouldn't say that, but on an Echo or something.
We were doing a project with BBC R&D at the beginning of the year, which we'd been working on for about 8 months, and sadly it got canned as well. That was using the Bose frames, which are really, really great fun, but unfortunately they're discontinuing them.
One of the things about those Bose frames was the sort of GPS and compass in it, gyroscope. I was trying to think of the word then. And they've been used with an app, a street map app called Soundscape, which Microsoft have developed. And they were using the Bose frames. And you would walk around and get the streets called out. But if you had a shop or something that you wanted to go to, and you moved your head, then the streets in your head would move around. So there's a lot that's sort of happening with those frames. But as you say, sadly, it looks like they may be discontinued, which is a bit of a shame.
Yeah, I mean, I really loved them. I mean, I thought they were, especially for binaural sound, they're amazing. And like you say, because of the compass and the ability to know which direction you're looking in, I thought it was an amazing bit of tech, something that is so helpful, you know, like exactly like you're saying, if you can look at a shop and go, it's there. You can do that and as you're sightseeing in Rome, and it can be like, turn to your right, there's the Colosseum, you know, how brilliant. But in terms of telling stories, how exciting that is as well. I mean, we developed a game for them where you essentially jumped through portals to go to places, and then everywhere you went, it used the augmented audio reality to add voices to the environment you're in already. And it was really, really great fun. I adore new tech, and working with BBC R&D is one of the greatest fun things you can possibly do in the entire universe. You just sit around and talk about stupid ideas, and then people say, yeah, let's do it. It's amazing.
Well, Ben, thank you very much indeed for your time today and chatting with me. It's been great to chat to you and find out more about the background to blindness, and also more about yours and Max's work. And I have seen some of your shows, not knowingly that they were yours. I saw PF at the Donmar long, long time ago. And as I said in my email, I saw Teenage Dick as well, which was, it's an interesting show.
We do shows like Blindness where we both work together, or Anna, where we're both co-creators together on it. And then we have shows like Teenage Dick where I got to see it on press night and Max did 90% of the work, and I did everything remotely with him. So we both wrote the music together, but I didn't see any of it until press night, which is quite strange. It's similar with things like Cyrano de Bergerac. I was in for all of the tech and all of the previews. Max did loads of work with me on the music, but never saw the show. So it's a funny one. Makes life a lot easier.
Yeah. Well, thanks again.
Oh, man, you're very welcome.
Do visit the Donmar Warehouse website, donmarwarehouse.com, for more details about blindness, links to Reclaiming Blindness, an audio interview between Simon Stevens and partially blind production consultant Professor Hannah Thompson, unpicking the representations of blindness in theatre, literature, and the Donmar's production of Blindness, plus links to the Vocalise website to listen to and download the audio-described introductory notes for Blindness. Do visit my website, tobydavy.co.uk, where you'll find other examples of my audio work via the embedded Audio Boom audio player on the home and radio and audio pages. You will also find details on how to contact me and follow me on social media. Do all keep safe and well.